Time Knife. That doesn't start the music. No one starts singing for a long time. It's got an intro there. Thanks for picking a song that doesn't cooperate.
You know what? I didn't pick it. I was going to sing a bit of it.
Yeah.
And I was not going to be sitting here for 30 minutes going, ga-jing, jing, ga-jing. But, whatever, Dave White. Okay, so this is a very special linoleum knife.
And that was not a tape player we still haven't bought.
No, we're still working on
that. We're giving you an extra episode for free.
That's right. We're so good to you people.
Unlike the Apple commentary, which costs $1.99 and yes, you should buy.
You absolutely should. PayPal $1.99 to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We will send you our mind-blowing DVD commentary for the very mind-blowing The Apple.
And we will tell you that about two more times before we're done with this.
But
this is Linoleum Knife.
It is a podcast of the cinema. I'm Dave White. I'm not.
Dave, yeah, you are. I'm Dave White
of movies.com.
It's radio. Who would know?
Exactly. It's a ventriloquist on
and
the radio.
I'm Alonzo Duralde of the rap.com. And what the flick? That's on the internet too.
And I'm Margaret Dumont. And I disapprove of both of you.
Joining us today is our very good friend and way too fancy for this show, Matt Zollerseitz.
We've had fancier than him.
I suppose, but he's up there.
Don't get a big head.
Yeah, we've had Manola on twice. So, Matt is the editor of RogerEbert.com and the author of the acclaimed and crazily popular new book, The Wes Anderson. It's not in front of me. What's
Collection.
It called? Collection. Thank you. That's what I thought it was, but I thought that can't be right. The Wes Anderson Collection.
The Wes Anderson Collection. A beautiful, large book.
A gorgeous coffee table book about, and really, let's face it, if you're doing a book about Wes Anderson, you cannot slap together something at Kinko's. Like, this guy puts so much visual effort into the fake books that are in his movies that a real book about him has to be a work of art itself, which it is. So
Thank you. Welcome
to the show, sir.
Thank you very much.
So this is exciting. You've been like hoofing it all over the place for this.
Yeah,
thing.
It's sort of like I'm as surprised as anyone that this book has been as popular as it has been, because if you've read it, you know it's an extremely nerdy book. Like at one point, we spend like four entire pages talking about why he uses the anamorphic lens in his early films. Like this is not like by any stretch of the imagination a book you would think would be popular, but it is. And I'm very happy about that. It's great.
Well, I think the rule is if you're going to use the word anamorphic, you know, lots of pictures.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, we actually made one of my very favorite clips related to this book was late last year we made Esquire's list of, I think it was like 32 books to buy for guys who won't read. And this was one of those books. And I thought, yay.
College education not wasted.
No, absolutely not.
Now I'm curious just if we're talking about the design of it all, like does he personally design the fake books in his films, or is there somebody else, and is that somebody else somebody who had something to do with your book? Or
the fake books in Wes's movies are designed by the production designer and the people who work for the production designer. Mm. But there's always a caveat. I get this question a lot, like how much input does Wes have into the costumes, into the lighting, into the set design and so forth, and the answer is none, and yet all. In the sense that he hires people who know what he likes.
Sure.
They know what Wes Anderson likes. So when he says, hey, I need somebody to do a mock-up of a cover for this book called Dudley's World for the Royal Tenenbaums, Wes is not sitting there personally photoshopping the book cover, but at the same time, it's being photoshopped by somebody who knows what Wes might like.
Sure.
And they probably bring it to him and he says, you know, different font and move the face, you know, 4 degrees to the right or something. But there is that level of meticulousness to his sense of design. And in fact, I did a screening of The Life Aquatic at the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens last fall to promote the book, and I talked to the cinematographer and the production designer on The Life Aquatic, and it was weird. It was like a support group. It was like a cathartic, like they both of these guys, like clearly that was an unbelievably difficult shoot. Right. Apparently every movie that shoots on water is the worst shoot of all time.
That's automatically a nightmare, yeah.
But Mark Friedberg, the production designer of that movie, really seemed to be working through some issues as I was talking to him. But they all had the same comments to make about Wes, which was that he knew everybody's job as well as the people doing the job knew their job, and everyone knew it. And like, it wasn't a question where you like humored the director by pretending that he knows what he's talking about, like he obviously did. And like, sure. The costume designer, Wes, would produce a stack of magazines from a particular era and go, pages 35, 26, and 41, like, make me something that looks like those dresses, you know?
Do you feel like the Midnight Coterie of Sinister Intruders got it right?
I mean, yeah! As a matter of fact, that was really a kind of a moment where I felt like, all right, this is sort of broken through in a way that these kind of books usually don't, because 2 days before that thing aired, there was a tweet from Seth Meyers recommending that they watch, that everybody watch all these videos that I'd done on the films of Wes Anderson that were on RogerEbert.com.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah, those were great.
And I read that and I thought, well, how nice. And then that parody of the Wes Anderson movies appeared on Saturday Night Live, and I thought, we were research. We were research. Yeah. It's great because, like, that means that we know what we're talking about.
Totally.
Yeah, so.
Now, it's interesting that your history with Wes Anderson traces back to the USA Film Festival in Dallas.
It does indeed.
Where I used to work, too. So it's kind of crazy. I was living out here, I think, when the short Bottle Rocket premiered there.
Yes.
But that was, so you got in on the ground floor of the Wes Anderson business, basically.
Well, I did. And in fact, I am the first person ever to critically review anything he did as a filmmaker. He told me that. And it was in that little piece that I did about Bottle Rocket, the short film, which played at the USA Film Festival. And I remember, I'll never forget, sitting there on the floor of this apartment on Cabell Avenue in Dallas in, you know, late 93 or early 94, going through a stack of videos. And you remember, I was like this insane person when I wrote for the Dallas Observer, where I felt like I had to review every single thing, like including all the shorts. So I'm sitting there, I'm watching like every feature, every short film. And so I watched all the short films in this program, and Bottle Rocket jumped out at me. And I always wanted to try to seek out local talent that seemed like they had something artistically interesting going on and sort of champion them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was... Wes's movie really jumped out at me because it seemed like the work of somebody who had a style that was fully developed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little shocked when I met him, because, you know, Wes Anderson was behind the camera and Owen Wilson and Luke Wilson were in front of it. So you're looking at this movie with Owen Wilson and Luke Wilson, you go, oh, those guys are about 23, 24 years old.
Yeah.
I had no reason to think that Wes Anderson was that age. Also, my assumption was that he was a guy who'd been bopping around Dallas-Fort Worth for a while. Maybe he was like an assistant professor somewhere.
Did some second unit on Walker, Texas Ranger.
Exactly, like somebody who had been around the block, but it turns out he was the same age as his actors and the same age as me. You know, all about the same age, you know, all of us, actually.
Mm.
So I wrote about the short film, and then I wrote a longer feature about him and Owen when they were looking for funding to turn it into a feature. And I think they had just gotten a nibble from Columbia, and I went and did another feature on them. And then I ended up following the production of Bottle Rocket from start to finish.
Wow.
Which was, in retrospect, kind of an amazing thing, because alternative weeklies don't do that really anymore.
Mm.
Where they, you know, they encourage you to report things, and they pay to send you places. And like, they were, you know, they sent me to L.A. for a couple of weeks to interview them when they were editing and all of that, you know, and like, I was going out to the set, and like, all the time that I was reviewing movies and I was writing features and news stories for Dallas Observer, I was also reporting certain long, like, you know, what do they call it, gathering string. You know, it was like gathering string for these things that weren't going to appear for months or years, but that was one of them. And at the time that that story ran, it was the longest story that had ever been published in Dallas. And at some point, it may have been supplanted by something else, but at the time, I held the record. And I was always perversely proud of that.
Oh, of course.
Please. That, you know, like Laura Miller's hard-hitting exposés of
city council chicanery.
Exactly. Like, you know, my story about these people who made a movie that nobody freaking saw was longer. Yay!
It's funny, back when I lived in Dallas, I don't know that they're as big a deal now, but for a while there was an organization called the 500 Inc. that was a very big deal.
Sure.
And people, they would get together, they raised a lot of money for arts groups, and then they would just disseminate it once a year, you know, that they had raised all year round at all these different events. And I, you know, as part of my gig at the festival, would have to go to certain, you know, parties or whatever, and Dave never, ever, ever wanted to go.
That's right.
The one time I was able to drag him to a 500 Inc. event was because they had it at the Frank Lloyd Wright house where they had shot a bunch of bottle rockets.
That's right. I remember that. And I was actually there for the shooting of those scenes.
Oh, cool.
House. Yeah, I was on set for a number of the scenes in that movie, including the scene where James Caan twists Andrew Wilson's hand at the Brookhaven Country Club.
Oh, right, right, right.
And also for that scene at the Frank Lloyd Wright house, and also the party at the loft in Deep Ellum where James Caan has the fake stuffed ocelot on his shoulder, and he's wearing a kimono, and he's got a top knot. And that was weird, and like I can tell the story now because one of the principals is gone, but I'll never forget James Caan, when he got that supporting part in Bottle Rocket, he had been in rehab for a while. Mm. It was his first film after this much publicized stint in rehab, and I interviewed him in between takes, in between, I guess, setups, and he gave me this lovely monologue about what he thought the title of Bottle Rocket meant. And I'm standing there interviewing James Caan with his ponytail and his kimono and his fake stuffed ocelot on his shoulder. And I'm thinking, like, wow, what great stuff I'm getting. And Polly Platt, who was one of the producers of The Last Picture Show, was standing off to the side staring at us the whole time. I was like, why is she mean mugging us? What the fuck? And she drew me aside afterwards and said, I need to ask you a favor. I need you to please not say that Jimmy was drinking when you interviewed him.
Oh.
And I said, okay, first of all, that's not a detail that I would ever have put in the story because, like, it just wouldn't occur to me to put that in.
Sure.
Like, I'm not the sort of person who puts in, like, what they were wearing, what they were drinking, what they were eating.
Right.
And, like, maybe that makes me a bad reporter, but I've just never done that.
Sure.
And secondly, I'm such a freaking idiot that I never would have known that he was drinking until you told me. Yeah, I thought it was a diet Sprite or something.
I just thought he was an actor, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was like a Sprite. I thought he was drinking a Sprite. And it's like, no, it was a white wine. But anyway, it ended up not I ended
when you
up
get
not
out of rehab, sometimes you need a little white wine.
Exactly. Well, it was funny because I didn't use that detail in the story because I suddenly had an ethical struggle about it. Like, now I've been asked by a producer of the film not to put a certain detail in the story. Am I morally obligated to put it in just to show that I can't be, you know? But who cares?
I love Polly Platt. I spent one amazing night with her in Dallas, driving her around in the snow.
One crazy night.
Crazy night with Polly Platt. Oh,
it was great. It was. She was such a sweetheart. She was in Houston making that awful sequel to Terms of Endearment.
The Evening Star.
The Evening Star. Thank you.
Yeah, which I wanted to like that.
Yeah,
I really did.
No, absolutely. I you know, but
like
no.
Texasville.
Exactly.
I really wanted to like Texasville.
Yeah.
And there are some people who do really, actually, genuinely like Texasville.
I'm
not among them.
No, I like Annie Potts in Texasville. That's about the only thing I even remember
brave.
In it. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Polly Platt, it was when Louis Malle died, and you know she wrote Pretty Baby.
Right.
So I just faxed her and I said, hey, look, would you be interested in coming up and we'll do a screening and you can talk about Louie and da da da. And she was like, oh yeah, I'd love to. And they're like, well, okay, we'll try and set up your travel. Oh no, I'll drive up. Drove herself up from Houston in the snow.
Oh which, my God.
As we know, Texas, like most places in the South, not equipped to deal with it.
No, they get totally paralyzed if there's like 1 inch of snow.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, but no, she got herself up there. I went and picked her up and took her to the theater and back. You know, we talked about Peter Bogdanovich. We talked about I'll Do Anything. Like, she just, there was no filter. She would talk about whatever. It was
Did
great.
She talk about what happened with the musical numbers in I'll Do Anything?
Yes. Yes.
Can you enlighten me? Because I always wondered, how can you record a complete score by Prince and not use it?
Basically, like, they were test audience to death. Like, that was, like, the consistent sort of negative thing coming back from the cards. People didn't like the musical numbers. And then when the idea rolled around of, like, well, you know, could we put them back for the video release or whatever, apparently by that point they would have had to pay Prince a whole bunch more money because they didn't use them the first time and the option expired. There was some weird legalese thing for that. And, of course, since the movie had died, the studio didn't want to put another dime into it. She described all of this. She goes, this is like talking about my baby that died.
Oh.
You know, but
what
was
a great original weird film that might have been, though, if we'd seen it in its original
form. I have a bootleg with a bunch of the songs from it, actually.
You do?
I do.
Oh my God!
I'll make you a copy.
Yes, you must.
And actually, there's a if Nick, when you're back.
Oh, look, Alonzo Duralde.
What?
You hit the microphone.
Oh well.
Not me.
It was part of my Dave White impersonation.
That was not
playing the long game.
That was not me hitting the microphone. Listeners, that was a long
time. Usually, Dave.
I just felt it was important
time,
to grind this conversation.
This one
to a
time,
halt
it wasn't.
And point that out.
Anyway, next time you're in town, yes. Cinephile Video, which we were talking about last night, it's over by the New Art. They have, you know, they have stuff that you can. They can't legally rent it to you, but you can check it out for free with a rental of something else. They have a work print of "I'll Do Anything." Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And it's got...
Oh!
It doesn't have all the numbers in it, but it's got a bunch of the numbers in it. It's astonishing.
I am pro-craziness in movies.
Absolutely.
I'm totally pro-craziness. And that's one of the reasons why Life Aquatic is my favorite Wes Anderson film. Hmm. Because he is not a sort of wild, undisciplined filmmaker, like where you expect like random stuff that doesn't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But Life Aquatic, and in fact, I've compared this movie to Temple of Doom for Spielberg. Like, you watch Temple of Doom, and one of the reasons I love Temple of Doom more than any other Indiana Jones film...
It's my favorite, too.
...is because I feel like it's an uncontrolled blast of Spielberg's id, and he's not thinking about how he's being perceived. Like,
sure.
He doesn't have that, like, I'm the president of Hollywood, I have to make sure that everything's okay with everybody.
Right.
He's not thinking about positioning, he's not thinking about how he looks or any of that. He's like ripping off the top of his head and showing you what's in it.
It's like, I want to see this movie.
It is. It's like, this is, like, him and George Lucas are working through some very deep, unpleasant issues in that film. And I feel the same way about Life Aquatic.
Mm.
And I'll Do Anything, I've been fantasizing about seeing that version of I'll Do Anything with the musical numbers, because when you look at James L. Brooks, and I adore James L. Brooks, when you look at James L. Brooks, never in a million years would you think he's the kind of guy who would say, you know what I really want to do? A Hollywood satire with musical interludes by Prince. You know? It doesn't make any sense. And the fact that it doesn't make any sense is what always made me, like, I was rooting for this film.
Sure. Yeah, no.
And the only part of that movie that I really, I even remember is... when Nick Nolte comes back to his apartment and he listens to his answering machine messages, and there's one from Julie Cavern going, "Guess who's gay? Call me back." And that's like all I remember with that thing.
I remember the whole speech that Julie Cavern has about when she's explaining to Albert Brooks that she loves him because women think they can change men, and that's why Beauty and the Beast did so well for women 18 to 34. I was living here at the time, and the LA Times, you know, I think Brooks regrets this now, but he apparently gave them crazy amounts of access to the post process. So they would just have these long, long articles about how the testing was going so terribly and how everybody was concerned and da da da. And I just thought, oh God, I want to see this movie and I'm never going to get to it.
Have you noticed this? That it seems like every, like, great series of articles or every great book that has ever been written about a movie where they gave them total access was a movie that didn't work. Like The Red Badge of Courage, Bonfire of the Vanities, you know?
It's true.
Yeah.
Nobody opens the doors on the ones that wind up being good.
Well, and in fact, Polly Platt brought that up to me in a conversation about this Bottle Rocket article.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she said,
oh, so it was your fault that it flopped. Is that
well,
it?
That well, actually, no. But what she said to me when I was reporting it was, she said, "There's never, to my knowledge, has anybody, any reporter who has been given total access to a production, ended up chronicling a film that succeeded." And you know, Wes let you do this against my advice.
Mm.
She told me flat out.
Huh.
And so, you know, I guess I'm responsible for the failure of Bottle Rocket.
Way to go, Sites. Hope you're happy.
I am not responsible for the failure of Bottle Rocket, because not only did I buy a ticket to see it, I forced two of my middle school teacher colleagues, at the time I was a middle school teacher in Fort Worth, on our spring break, I forced them to go with me over to the AMC 24 in Dallas to see Bottle Rocket. Then we tried to sneak into Il Postino immediately
oh,
after.
Oh, and your friend ruined it.
And she ruined it because she was so damn friendly to everybody.
Il Postino, ugh.
And And we wish we had snuck into Il Bustino because it was bad. And but they loved Bottle Rocket, so I bought 4 tickets.
I did see it opening weekend in Dallas. I can't remember with who. Probably with my colleague.
With me, probably.
Wait, and then you saw it again with your teacher pals?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe so. I can't remember. But it's interesting.
Everything
that,
you did was with me.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
I'm
don't
everything.
You forget it.
I'm everything I am because you loved me.
You got that right.
I have to say, Zissou, not my favorite. Darjeeling Limited.
Don't like it?
Yeah, I left wanting the luggage and the towels, but I did not.
God,
I was not
yeah.
moved by it. I was not. I don't know. I didn't. But the ones of his that I like, I really, really like. I mean, Rushmore is still probably my favorite. Fantastic Mr. Fox, I think, is great. And I know you think it's reductive, but I really think that he should just make animated films from now on because he just loves to work in diorama anyway.
Well, he kind of does, but some of my favorite filmmakers work that way, like Tati.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so that's fine. Like, that's a particular mode to work in. But Anderson, it's funny. People keep asking me, what do you think of Grand Budapest Hotel, which mm-hmm. I've seen twice now. And I love it. But, gee, that's a shock. Like, I have an affinity. I have an affinity for Wes Anderson's work, and I always have. And you know, he's on the list of filmmakers I'm in the tank for, like, along with Terrence Malick and Michael Mann and people like that. Like, I've never seen a Michael Mann film, even The Keep, that I didn't, like, respond to somehow emotionally. I don't know why. I don't know why it is, but...
Yeah, because, I mean, I have, I can't... I was trying to think of, apart from Nicole Holofcener, who never works, there's of reasonably prolific filmmakers. I can always point to one and go, left me cold. Even like I love Todd Haynes, but Velvet Goldmine didn't do it for me.
Right, there's always one movie.
I love John Waters, Cecil B. DeMented. I don't get it. You know, like there's Hitchcock. Anybody I can pick out one and go, I don't know where they were on about. But that's why I've never written a
Bottle
book about
Rocket
an entire
is that
filmography.
Film for me.
Really?
Yeah, it is in Wes Anderson's filmography, and it's not to say I don't like it. I do. I like it a lot, and mm-hmm. I have a tremendous personal affection for it for obvious reasons
sure.
because it's part of my biography too. But I don't feel like Wes Anderson really became Wes Anderson until Rushmore.
Interesting.
And this is a case where, like, I know that people make a case for directors needing producers to, interfere and limit them and tell them no and all that stuff. And I think that's true for most artists of any kind. Like, writers need editors, filmmakers need producers, and so forth. But in Wes's case, I feel like it's better if you just let him do whatever he wants and see what happens. Like, he's one of those few filmmakers where I think that's actually... to everyone's net gain.
Sure.
And Bottle Rocket, when I watch Bottle Rocket, I feel like it is a James L. Brooks film directed by Wes Anderson.
Hmm.
And there's tremendous pressure, and he talks about this, and this is actually in the story that I wrote for Dallas Observer, and we get into it again in the book in an oblique way. But he was a young guy, 23, 24 years old, directing a studio film. He'd never directed anything except a short before. And there was... pressure to make the film more commercial, to make it more accessible, whatever that meant.
Hmm.
And then he made Rushmore, which was not a big hit financially, but critically very successful.
Right.
And I feel like Rushmore is the movie where he plants his hands on his hips and jumps out and goes, ta-da, this is me.
I think that's accurate.
It's
yeah.
widescreen. There's like 45 different details in every frame. Like
right.
you don't notice. Like you can watch the movie 16 times and not get everything. And that's the mode he's been working in ever since. And Grand Budapest Hotel, even more so.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about that more when the movie comes out. I've seen it. Watching it was exhilarating, and then very soon after it was over, I felt like the entire thing had just turned into a fine mist and flown out of my head. And maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
Right.
And I will see it again. And maybe repeated viewings will change that. But I just kind of during the ride, I was like, wow, this look at oh man, you know, it was so exciting to
the
watch.
The ski chase is insane.
Oh, yeah, that's
insane.
I mean,
like, those long shots of the characters, and they're, like, obviously animated stick figures.
Yes.
And they're not even trying to hide it. Like, they're not even moving like real people. Yeah, you know? They're like Goofy on skis or something.
And you have the pink pastry box of a hotel, and then you have actual pink pastry boxes.
Yes,
you know, and stuff like that. Yeah. I mean, I had a great time watching it. And then, and I think I came home, and I was still sort of vibrating. And then by the time I went to bed that night, I was like,
here's what I would say about that. Like, I had a reaction that was somewhat similar the first time I saw it. Like, mm-hmm. I saw it, like, back in November or December of last year, and it wasn't done yet. Like, they hadn't color-corrected it, and there were some special effect shots that were clearly kind of placeholder shots. But I had a somewhat similar reaction, which was, this is light, frothy, and exciting. Like, this is like a... more in the mode of a Fantastic Mr. Fox kind of film. But then I saw it a second time, and it felt more substantial to me. And so I would say, you know, see it a second time, because you may have that reaction to it, and it's because of the Ralph Fiennes character and his relationship with the F. Murray Abraham character as a young man. And Rushmore, in fact, the movie that it reminds me of in terms of its kind of emotional wavelength is Rushmore.
Sure.
In that, the first time I saw Rushmore, I thought, what a wonderful, light, charming, exciting, pop kind of film. And then I saw it again, and I felt the same way, but there was something that was gnawing at me about it. Like, something kind of, there was a kind of melancholy quality to it. And I've seen Rushmore, I mean, I've seen all of his films many, many times because I wrote this book, but... Rushmore, every time I see Rushmore, it seems like a harder, darker, sadder film to me.
It does get more melancholy the more times you see it.
It does, and like this last time I was really like moved by it. Like, I've seen that movie probably 30 times now, you know? And the last time I saw it, it was like at a friend's house. They happened to have it on, and it really kind of ripped me up, like in the way that Life Aquatic and parts of Royal Tenenbaums do. And that's a movie that usually you put it on a list with like Life Aquatic, Moonrise Kingdom, and Fantastic Mr. Fox of films that you show to people who've never seen a Wes Anderson film to get them into him.
Right.
Yeah. Because it's light. Like, it doesn't take a lot out of you.
No.
And yet you see it again, and it does. Like, it takes a little bit more out of you each time. I don't know if I'm really recommending anything by saying that, but... it's sneaky.
Obviously, you've done a lot more thinking about his filmography than I have. A phrase that came to mind, though, when I was writing about Grand Budapest Hotel was the idea that I feel like a recurring thing in his films is a distrust of authority, but a love of mentors.
Oh, completely.
You know, like father figures fare a lot better than fathers.
Oh my God! Yeah, movies, that's true. Where were you when I was writing this book? I would totally steal that. Yeah, it's true. It's totally true. And Royal Tenenbaum being probably the best example of that.
Sure.
And also Mr. Fox.
Yeah.
And in fact, I keep telling this to people and nobody will believe me. But the Fantastic Mr. Fox, I don't believe that that movie really has a happy ending. Because if you look at how it ends, like they, you know, they're in Bogus Bunsen Bean's supermarket, but everyone has lost their home because they chose to follow Mr. Fox. Like, Mr. Fox got his tail shot off, and he's wearing, you know, this tail pinned to his butt. It's, and you know, I called it a haunch piece. And his family, you know, he's proposing a toast as if it's, you know, still Thanksgiving. And everyone is still so much under the sway of his charisma that they react as if everything is hunky-dory. But it's not. Like, they can't go above ground anymore. The homes they used to live in, the boroughs they used to live in, like the normal stable life that they used to have is gone because they chose to follow Mr. Fox. And, you know, and I love that about the movie, that you sit there like, you know, you sit there thinking
they're
like...
dancing to a song.
Yeah, they're dancing to a song. Like, because they're dancing to a song, you're like, yay, it's the end of Rushmore, everybody's happy. But the next time they go above ground, they could get shot at.
I think they're going to be fine.
I will look at it again through those eyes. That's an interesting take. Yeah. I have not had a chance to really sink my teeth into the new Criterion yet, but it looks like it's got... I did look at the White Cape comic book. But that's
yes. Yeah.
So now you are also, in addition to your, I don't know how you do all this, frankly, but you're editing Ebert. You're also the TV critic for Vulture.com.
Right.
So you are keeping very, you are soaking in what a lot of people would argue is the exciting medium right now, which is television.
Yeah, well, yeah, and in fact, Roger Ebert, who was like, he was a mentor to a lot of people, including me, but somebody asked Ebert one time, how do you write so much? And his answer was, I spend more time writing than most people do not writing. That was his answer. And, like, I give the same answer, although I'm not on the level of a Roger, and I'm probably never going to be, but, like, I definitely, you know, I write fast, I write a lot, and I don't, like... I feel like if I'm going to spend my my boredom time, if I'm going to fill it up with something, it might as well be with writing. But so that's how I'm able to do it. But I do love TV, and I have been writing about television and film simultaneously for like 15 or more years now. And I'm glad that I did that, because like I always approached film and television is in more or less the same way, which is kind of writing about them aesthetically. Like writing about, like, how do they, what story are they telling and how do they tell it? Mm-hmm. And what choices do they make creatively? And it was weird because, I mean, you guys know this, but as recently as the mid-90s or the late 90s, there was still a hierarchy where film was the superior medium. And anybody who was a film critic full-time would kind of sneer at anybody who wrote about TV. Yeah. And even stuff that was arguably really interesting, like The Sopranos or The X-Files or The West Wing or something like that, or Seinfeld, which I think is, you know, a gold mine that hasn't been exhausted yet, film critics would sort of look at you as if you were lavishing your time on something that wasn't worthy of being even talked about, you know, compared to, you know, the glories of cinema.
Right.
And I feel like I don't believe in that dichotomy. Like, I don't believe that, you know, television is more important than film now. Like, or, you know, all the creative action is on TV. I don't think that's true. I just think they're different media.
Well, I think that the, you know, the ratio of, let's say, you know, Grown-Ups 2 versus Gravity, you know, is getting more equivalent to the ratio of, you know, 2.5 Men to The Wire, you know, in terms of, like, I think for a long time, TV, there were the nuggets that you could sort of point to. It was like, this is great, and this is great, and this is great. And then all of this is still fairly kind of mediocre. I think now there's certainly no shortage of mediocrity on television, but there's more, this is great to talk about.
Well, I think in scripted TV, it's more interesting.
Yeah.
I think scripted TV with actors and plots, I think it is altogether more interesting than commercial cinema, like American, at least. Mm-hmm. And certainly, when you look at romantic comedies or just comedies generally, like I can't remember the last time I saw a comedy in a movie theater that was, you know, a tenth as interesting as even a mediocre comedy on TV. Like How I Met Your Mother, like during a bad week, is more interesting than most of the rom-coms that open in theaters.
That's true.
You know, and I don't know how that happened, but it did.
I would argue for Enough Said and Before Midnight, although those are those are both very dramatic,
right?
Comedies,
and you just picked them out on two fingers.
True,
there is, but it's different. It's just different, and like there's this component of TV which is there is no equivalent in film unless you're somebody like a John Cassavetes or a Spike Lee, where everything that airs on TV is improvised. In to some degree, and like I've learned this from talking to the people who make television, that even the shows that seem heavily planned out in advance, where they're thinking like, we know we're going to start here in episode 1 and by episode 10 or 13 or 22 we're going to end up here, all that middle stuff, they don't know exactly how they're going to get there. And there's all these obstacles in the way, like an actor who is part of the regular cast suddenly, you know, gets pregnant or develops a drug habit or just decides they don't like being on the show or they don't like playing that character and they have to leave, and you have to figure out how to account for it.
Right.
Or maybe there's a key location that you always use and suddenly it's not available anymore. Like there's like a million things that could happen during the course of a season where you have to adapt, and that improvisation becomes part of the story.
Mm. you have to keep killing off the people at Downton Abbey because they get movie deals, you know.
Yeah, totally. And in fact, even the Sopranos, like the hallowed Sopranos, had to deal with that. Like, yeah. I've heard that Robert Loggia's character was written out because he couldn't remember his lines.
Huh. Well, and there was that whole thing where they had hired Fairuza Balk to play the undercover agent, and then she was right. like, what, more than one episode? Nah. Yeah. And so then they had to reshoot the whole thing with Lola Guadini, who then played the part.
Right, right.
I've got a store for witches to tend to on Cahuenga. I can't be doing this.
Yeah.
So when you got here, we were talking about how amazing Girls has been this season.
Oh my God!
Who also lost a care an actor?
Yeah, exactly. The guy playing Charlie was like, "I'm out."
He's out, and in fact, I'm glad he's out because oh my God, I think it's been great for the character of Marnie. Like, not personally because she's suffering, but like for us as the audience,
absolutely. Yeah,
yeah. It's great, and he's an absent presence on the show.
Mm. Well, I think one of the cool things about a lot of the... Now, you're okay, hitting your
that
mic.
That was me. That was
Dave
me.
Wise hitting his mic. One of the cool things about shows like Girls and The Sopranos, whatever, is there's that traditional notion of television as we grew up watching it on the three networks, that there was a certain status quo that would be challenged but ultimately maintained by the end of the hour, you know.
Yes.
And now you have shows where people can die, you know, or
right.
people can,
right.
you know, act completely differently or go down some bizarre path and not quickly reverse course, you know.
They won't necessarily replace you with a new Becky. They will just
exactly,
kill
yeah.
you.
You know, and
kill you.
And that's not just cable. I mean, like, you know, I think Joss Whedon certainly opened that possibility in a lot of ways, you know.
Yeah, he did.
So it's, yeah, it's that, so that's, that makes it more exciting.
It does. And also, I think the great discovery of The Sopranos, and I think maybe Seinfeld got there first and they've never gotten credit for it, because they were comedy probably, but this thing that people always used to use as a rap against TV, which is people don't change.
Right.
Yeah.
The Sopranos said, yeah, but it's true. It's actually true. And like, let's right. like, rather than denying that, which is what, you know, most quote unquote legitimate or respectable dramas do, they decided to make it the subject of the show.
Right, that no one learns anything.
Nobody
ever.
Learns anything. Like, once in a while they do, but, and in fact, David Chase has argued about this with different people, but I don't think the message of The Sopranos is people don't change ever, but just that it's incredibly hard and most people are too lazy to follow through with it.
Right. They would you just know? Assume not.
They would just the assume option. Not. And yeah, and I feel like Girls, not only is Girls aware of that, but there's a moment coming up in the next episode that's airing where they talk about that directly, where they're essentially saying, and these are characters who are in their mid-20s, and they're saying... Right. I am basically the person that I'm always going to be. Get off my jock about changing. You know? Like, accept me. Like, you've got to accept me as 80 to 90% of who I already am. Otherwise, we're just never going to work.
Interesting.
And I love that. I love that because it's real.
Well, that was, you know, in talking about looking last week on What the Flick, I brought up how in Difficult Men, the guy brings up the notion that you know, complicated guys get an hour and complicated women get half an hour. And apparently complicated homosexual men also get half an hour.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
I thought this week's Looking was a real game changer. I think,
oh, it's a great show. It's a great show. And like, that's one of those moments, and it usually had, what was it, episode five?
Five, yeah.
It was five. Usually I've found, isn't it amazing how it often happens at some, it's either episode four or five.
Mm.
When they have that moment where they figure out where they suddenly they're firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
I'm now warming to Looking.
Yeah.
I was just sitting back and hoping.
Yeah.
For Looking.
Yeah.
At first.
Wishing and hoping and thinking and praying.
Wishing and hoping, yeah. But this episode, this most recent episode, really, now I will go with them now.
Yes.
And
it's a get on the train episode, yeah, I call it. Yeah. It's like, all right, I'm on the train now and I'm going to stay on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I'm still waiting to figure out why these men are friends. but other than that, I'm still on board now.
Yeah.
Now, Matt, you're one of the very, very, very few film critics I know who has made a feature film.
Yes.
A film movie called Home. People should. It's findable, right? You can get
Absolutely,
it.
Yeah. Okay. It's on Netflix and other Fandor.
Nice.
Some other places, yeah.
Did you come out of that experience? Did it change you as a critic at all? Do you cut more slack? Do you sort of view things in a different way, having looked through the viewfinder yourself, or were did you, if anything, did you feel like you're having been a critic colored your filmmaking more than vice versa?
Well, it's hard to say. Like, I guess it's a chicken and the egg sort of thing, but I definitely felt, I know that there was a period of about a year after I finished principal production on that feature that it was hard for me to go to a movie and just be in the movie.
Hmm.
That I would spend the first, like, 20 or 30 minutes going, where are the lights? I was actually thinking, like, where did they position the lights? Like, how did they get that, like, that sharp kind of etching thing on the side of the actor's face? Like, they must have had a lamp over there, you know? you know, that's obviously detrimental if you're a critic, because you need to try to at least see the movie in the way that most people do, which is as a thing that's just happening.
Sure.
But I wouldn't say that it made me easier or harder on any particular kind of film, except that I will say it changed me in one way, which is for the most part, I don't review very, very, very small independent films unless I like them.
Mm.
Because I don't want to be, you know, because I know how hard it is. I know how hard it is to make a movie. Like, the budget of my first feature was $38,000 from start to finish. And the cast was, like, anybody I knew who was A, a professional actor, or B, comfortable on camera. Like, I felt like every professional actor I could get who would agree to act in the film was in the movie. And the ones who wouldn't do it, like, I replaced them with people who weren't really actors but didn't seem completely panicked on camera.
And you shot it entirely in your house.
I shot it entirely in my house, and it took 18 months to shoot it.
Wow.
You know, it could be because people had jobs. Right. You know, I had a job. They all had jobs. And in fact, people don't believe me when I tell this, but it's the truth. Like, 1/8 of the budget of that movie was hair. 1/8. Because all the actors had these cool haircuts. They had these cool haircuts that were like fancy salons.
For a year and a half.
And some of them had like dye elements. Like, they had a little bit of red here, a little bit of blonde, and they all had like fancy schmancy people who were cutting their hair. And every time we shot, there'd be a gap of like 3 months or 6 months before we'd shoot again, and I had to pay for them to go back.
They had to go back to Mr. Ronaldo.
They always had to go to that guy. Right, yeah. But it's tricky, and in fact, I was very heartened when, you know, as I was cutting the film, I realized that one of the actors, like, their hair clearly, you know, they shot a bunch of stuff and their hair was a particular color, and I said, you got to go back and get exactly the same haircut with exactly the same color for continuity, and here's a picture of yourself. But the picture that I gave him was a screenshot from some of the footage, and it wasn't color corrected.
Dope.
And they came back and the hair was substantially redder than the last time, and we shot them, and I was sitting there editing the movie going, oh my God, his hair suddenly became much redder. What do we do? And then I was reading this book called My First Feature or My First Film, and it was just interviews with directors about their first film. And Pedro Almodovar told this story about how his first feature, he had an actress, and it was shot the same way. It was like, you know, whenever he had money, they would shoot a scene or two.
Right.
And there was this one actress who, there was a scene where they had a wide shot. He did the whole scene in wide shot, and he wasn't happy with it. And they went back and did some medium shots, like 2 or 3 months later. And then he still wasn't happy, and he went back and got some close-ups. And he cut them all together, and he realized her hair obviously changed style from shot to shot. And he said, what am I going to do? Am I going to have to raise a few $1,000 and shoot the entire scene again, or do I just cut it together and hope no one noticed? And he said, you know, this was like 30 years ago or something. He said, no one has ever asked me about it. And I felt a lot better at that point.
One of my favorite quotes from, of all people, Bruce LaBruce.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Who made Hustler White and Super 8.5.
He's a real stickler for continuity.
And my very favorite, No Skin Off My Ass.
One of the greatest of all time.
His favorite quote, my favorite quote from him, that I actually used and titled an article about him, was, I don't give a damn about continuity.
Yeah.
Like, that's what he said. And so when I heard him say that, I thought, good, because neither do I. So anyway.
One of my producers on Holmes actually said that to me. I was freaking out about the hair issue. And he said, and he was actually had a blunt hanging out of his mouth at the time. and he listened to me, you know, practically on the edge of tears about this issue. And then he said, and I said, what are we going to do? And he said, And he took the blunt out of his mouth. He said, "Continuity is for pussies." And then he put it back in and continued smoking.
Just ask Tommy Wiseau.
Oh my God, yes. There's going to be a movie about the making of The Room. Is that actually happening?
I will believe it when I see it. But yeah, apparently.
Directed by James Franco.
James Franco and Seth Rogen.
Apparently, he's just going to go around destroying the fun and everything. Is that what he's doing now?
I liked Interior Leather Bar.
It was interesting. It was interesting.
It didn't ruin Cruising for me, you know?
Yeah, no.
Nothing can ruin Cruising.
No. Heavens, no.
I don't know. I'm torn between wanting to applaud James Franco and wanting to slap him, you know?
I think it was a Family Guy joke where somebody just had they had painted on a wall, "That's enough, John Mayer." There are times where it's like,
yeah,
"That's enough, James Franco." Like, yes, just take exactly. Take a month off.
Is he really, you know, is he Lawrence of Arabia? You know, is he going to, like, you know, he's the straight guy who's going to unite all the disparate tribes of gays against the Ottoman Empire. What is happening? Yeah, I don't know. It was a bit much. It just seemed, some of that stuff where he's being interviewed seemed a bit much to me.
I am pro Franco because he's a movie star who is weird.
He is.
And, true.
And there just are not enough.
Yeah, not a lot of people use their fame for art. Or as an art prank. And so I kind of dig that aspect of it.
I want him to keep doing that. Because even if a bunch of what he does is dumb or worse, something's going to be rad eventually.
Yeah, and we don't have to see all of it. Like, I've still never seen As I Lay Dying, and I probably never will. But
no.
It's okay if he makes it, I guess.
Yeah.
I just wish he didn't have that kind of Michael Winterbottom Spike Lee thing where it feels like he's just doing too much.
Mm.
I wish he would just slow down and, like, do fewer things. I think it would be better.
Well, apparently, the only thing that's really where it's really taking the toll is that he's not really earning any of these degrees. Like, I hear he doesn't do his homework, and, you know, like, you hear these stories from people who are in his courses or that he doesn't do anything, but he sort of pressures them into, like, passing him along anyway.
Allegedly. Look at the guy. Like, there's no possible way he could be doing his homework.
Right.
He's like, he's writing novels and short fiction, he's directing films, and he's acting in other people's movies, and like, it's not physically possible that he could be going to class.
There aren't that many audiobooks in existence that he could be listening to them on airplanes or whatever.
Definitely.
So what's coming up that you're excited about?
Well, geez, I don't know, on the movie front. I've seen the news, the first, like, 5 episodes of The Americans, and I'm very excited about that.
I'm rapidly zipping through season 1 so we can start doing recaps on what the flicks
are. I like that show a lot, and I feel like it's kind of the show that I wanted Homeland to be.
You know, after season 1, Homeland has not been setting me as on fire as it did, and I'm still sticking it out, but it's... Although I gotta say, the Americans, I kind of feel like they're not as rigorous about the anachronisms as, say, the Mad Men folks are.
No, they're really not. But I think that's a matter of budget.
I guess.
Anything else? And they're better. This season 2, it's better than season 1.
Okay, because there are some scenes like where they're out on the street and there's like a couple of cars near them that are, you know, K cars or whatever. But if you look in the far distance, there's some SUVs going.
Yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah, there are.
Back to hair.
Yeah,
I get very upset about hair in these periods. Films,
yeah.
TV shows, particularly TV shows.
You think Kerry Russell's too pretty?
I think her hair's wrong.
Her hair is wrong.
Yeah, and
it needs to be more ironed.
It needs to be more puffy. I believe it needs to be more that terrible
post Farrah kind of
that terrible early 80s Dorothy Hamill leftover sort of thing. That was still happening.
Bouncing and Behaving.
Yeah. Right. There's
I haven't heard that.
It's wrong.
Phrase like, I have not heard since.
Kind of a Tony Tennille sort of...
What was the show that came on after Mad Men, set like in Florida or whatever? What was the name of that show? The
Cuban show.
Jeffrey...
Dean Hunter?
What's his name?
The Miami show
set in the early 60s.
Like naked
right.
nudes or something.
I've reviewed it and I can't even remember the title.
I watched 2 episodes.
Not Havana.
The hair.
No, but it was something like that.
You could tell that the cast was like, no, I'm not, I'm not doing that to my hair. You can't make me.
Yeah.
And then they're
not paying me enough.
And then they just said, okay. Like, you're fine. You can have hair from 2012.
It was like it was like Loretta Swit's hair from season 2 of MASH onward.
Yeah.
It was totally Jose Bear. You know?
It's always been the deal breaker in period pieces. Like, even like a movie I adore, Last of the Mohicans. That's not 1757 hair. Right. It's just not.
On him or her?
Both of them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's like, you know, he's living in the woods, but apparently he's got access to conditioner.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, Mary McDonnell in Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, that prairie shag.
Yes.
Yeah.
She got a Brazilian blowout.
So if you can convince me that the Americans is good enough to overlook the hair...
I'm only 3 episodes in, but if Matt says it, right. You can take that to the bank.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Movie-wise, anything?
No, not at the moment, although I'm almost ashamed to say that I'm really looking forward to the new Star Wars movie.
Fair enough.
It's like, you know, the food is terrible in such small portions. Like, why would you want to see another Star Wars movie at this point?
Because I believe that something good can happen.
And it's, you know, I'm still giving J.J. Abrams the benefit of the doubt. I didn't hate Star Trek Into Darkness the way a lot of actual Star Trek people did.
Me neither.
I had a good time. You know, I don't carry around the Wrath of Khan as holy writ. So, you know, I didn't care that they were futzing with it.
Right.
I'm curious to see what he does with this, you know, set
I
want to
see Boyhood.
Boyhood is great.
Have you seen it?
I saw it at Sundance. God. It's so great.
Yeah.
It lives up to the idea of it. You know, it's not just that it was a cool gimmick. It actually it pays off, and he does interesting things with it, and it's really emotionally fulfilling.
Linklater is impressive.
He is.
He's an impressive filmmaker.
He is. And it's funny because I realize that there's still, I never got around to seeing Me and Orson Welles. I never got around to seeing Fast Food Nation. Like, I have some gaps there.
Yeah, he's good. Like, even when he's not really sort of firing on all cylinders, he's still interesting. And he's still doing movies like nobody else is doing. And Bernie is one of my favorite of his movies.
So great.
Like, I've seen that probably 3 or 4 times.
Bernie is so smart and so funny. And
one of the great Texas films of all time.
Gets Texas in a way that most movies do not get.
In a deep way. Yes. A deep way. And that explanatory, like, all the different, like, there's like 5 Texases.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
I was like, ah.
Someone finally explained it. And you know, I made a joke one time, one year at the LA Film Critics Dinner, I was giving an award to the... to the American Splendor people.
Right.
And I said, I think the new test of any docudrama is, can you incorporate the actual people in the movie and have them fit comfortably side by side with the fake people?
Well, and not have you immediately go, I wish I was watching a documentary.
Sure.
Well, that too, I feel like that's a test. And like, it was a testament to the overall power of Malcolm X that when I saw footage of the real Malcolm X, I wasn't thinking, gee, I wish I hadn't been watching Denzel Washington for 3 hours.
Right.
You know, but that doesn't always happen.
I mean, what I thought was so cool about Bernie was that I had to wait for the closing credits to find out who was an actual person and who wasn't.
Right. Yes.
Because there were actors who I thought were also, you know, real people from the town.
Have you seen an Alex Karpovsky film called Woodpecker?
I have not. I know he's a filmmaker, right?
Okay, well, Alex Karpovsky, I got to put in a word for this guy.
All right.
I think he's a major American filmmaker that nobody has discovered yet. And I've seen almost all of his films.
How many are we talking?
4 or 5 now, I think.
Features.
And he works in this sort of mode where he makes films that blur the line between documentary and fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And his first film, The Whole Story, which he starred in, and wrote and directed, is about this guy who goes to Brainerd to do a documentary about this mysterious hole that has opened up in the ice on this lake. And when he gets there, the hole has closed up. And he's faced with the choice, like, do I just pack it in and go home, or do I still try to make a film? And he decides to make a film, and he decides to interview the people of Brainerd about the hole in the ice as if it still exists. And you see him correcting their verb tense. And as it turns out, this is he actually went there intending to make a documentary about the hole in the ice. And the footage of him trying to get people to lie and talk about it in the past tense is like his attempts to salvage it. And when he has an emotional breakdown in the movie, that's actually, you know, he actually had an emotional breakdown while he's making the movie.
Hmm. And anyway, so he's cheating, basically.
He's sort of cheating. Well, you could say he's cheating, or you could also say he's making art out of disaster. And Woodpecker, and I say this as somebody who had seen his two previous films. Woodpecker is his third movie. Woodpecker is about this swamp. I think it's like in Arkansas or something, where a guy sees a woodpecker that is believed to have been extinct since the late 1940s, and he files a report, and all these bird watchers converge on the town to see this woodpecker that was believed to have been extinct. And there's some question as to whether or not this guy faked seeing the woodpecker.
Hmm.
And they have all these interviews with people in the town about the woodpecker, and they're real people. And Karpovsky does this again and again in his movies, where he's essentially creating the conditions of a documentary, but he's kind of inserting fiction into it. Hmm. And the main character of Woodpecker, who's the guy who sighted the woodpecker, I don't want to give it away, but suffice to say that you don't know which parts of this movie are quote-unquote real and which aren't.
Interesting.
And it kind of doesn't matter. Like, it's not like the point of the film is to guess what's real and what's fake. That like, he's kind of beyond that. And I love seeing him on Girls because I like him as an actor. He's got a charming, weird, kind of unusual presence, but most of the people watching Girls don't know what a formidable filmmaker this dude is. Like, he's like a young Albert Brooks. Like, he's that level of brilliant.
Wow, okay.
And abrasive too.
All right.
Like, you're watching his movies and you're kind of watching them through the fingers of one hand because you don't want to watch it. Like, it's too mortifying.
Are these getting distributed? I mean,
barely.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
He's turning into the person that Christina Ricci used to be in my life. The person
your stalker?
I keep running into everywhere I go.
You keep running into Alex Karpovsky?
Yeah, like, he's shown up in three places where I've been in the past 2 months. And so every time I see him, I'm like, you again. Like, it was Christina Ricci, and then the Rodarte girls.
Right, right.
And now him. Yeah.
Huh. Like, you run in very rarefied circles.
It's true.
Matt, this has been so great.
Thank you for
doing our first sort of freestanding special, but what the hell. So yeah, the book is the Wes Anderson Collection. It's gorgeous. It is the most focused read you will ever have about the still young but already prolific career of Wes Anderson. You can find Matt at Vulture.com, where he is our TV critic. You can follow him on Twitter at Matt Zollersites.
Yep.
MattZollersites. And he is the editor-in-chief of...
That's not too much to remember.
No. And he is the editor... we'll post a link on our Facebook page. He's the editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com. Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
And it's always, you know, we always have a mic for you here.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you.
So we'll be back this Sunday with our regular scheduled program, and we'll be talking about dumb movies like Pompeii that opened this week. And
oh my God, I want to see that.
Wow.
Is it Sucktastic?
It's Paul W.S. Anderson.
Oh.
Working with the star of Sucker Punch.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's pretty much what it is.
Expectations accordingly
over. So anyway, we'll catch you next time.
Buy that Apple commentary, damn you.
Yes. It's a mere $1.99, and it's chock full of information and...
Chocked.
And charm. It's a charm offensive.
Are we done?
We're done.
Okay. Goodbye.